never go anywhere. So being in orbit around Ceres and having an extremely small amount of thrust, you cannot blast straight away from Ceres. What you've got to do is blast at right angles so that your orbit slowly grows in circumference or in altitude, and eventually that altitude becomes so large that you escape. That's a bunch of guesses on my part. I wonder if any of that was detailed as to how you leave the orbit of Ceres and then reestablish an orbit around, leave the orbit of Vista and reestablish an orbit around Ceres. I think it's a set of expanding spirals in the beginning and descending spirals at the end. I wonder if that's approximately it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Oh yeah, that's how they have to do it, and they have the three ion engines to work with. The exhaust, I think, was 200,000 miles per hour, so, you know, to get to the speed of light. You could probably do it with lighter gases. Xenon is a heavier gas. It might have a little bit better faster thrust, but, you know, they like the xenon gas because it's a heavier gas, easier to work with than, for instance, they could do it with lighter ions, but all the ion engines that have gone up before, you know, since Smart One, that was a xenon gas, Hayabusa 1, now Hayabusa 2 by Japan, also was xenon gas. So they all use that. And I think it's about 200,000 miles per hour exhaust. The approach right now to Cirrus is around 400 miles an hour. They're closing in on it. They got a long way to go, though. It's about twice the distance from the moon right now. It's around 400,000 miles away.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, interesting analogy. But ion engine. The ion engine is pretty much common thing. And you need initial jump in order to get to the highest speed and then use it. The same thing is being used in the vacuum pumps for the bell jars. You have graphic pump and then you have ionic engine. That ionic engine actually, due to the potential of, say, 3 to 7 kilovolts, allows the ions to accelerate and then capture the residue, which is the particles of gas or whatever is there. So in space, what we have is we have already vacuum. And then all we need is just to create some of the ionic power that will eventually, in the long run, reach a huge speed, but you need that first thrust at the beginning of. Do you agree with that, and to achieve?
Yeah, I can see why we're not going to be using ion engines on the planet to leave, but once you're in space, you stand a chance. Now, xenon gas is a noble atom. It doesn't mix with anything. It's got an outer ring of electrons that's completely filled. In order to store as much xenon gas as possible, to make it compact, I'd like the xenon gas to be in liquid form. And then you boil off the liquid form into a gas, put it into the beginning of the engine where you ionize it. In other words, you separate the electrons from the protons. I think you shoot the electrons off to one side of the engine and they get captured. And the protons are what you actually accelerate. The heavy nucleus of the xenon atoms are what you really accelerate out the exhaust nozzle. That's what I think goes on. So my first question is, Paul, is the xenon gas able to be stored in liquid form? Because I'm guessing you can get a lot more mass per cubic centimeter in liquid form than you can by compressing the xenon gas, leaving it in a compressed form. It'd be nice if the xenon gas, without going to some ridiculously high pressure, could be liquefied at what I'm going to call room temperature. everything can be liquefied if you go down to cryogenic temperatures, but maintaining cryogenic temperatures in space, that represents an engineering problem. So if you happen to know how much xenon gas, is it liquid, and any idea of the amount of thrust they get out of it, you told us it's got an exhaust velocity of 200,000 miles an hour. If we knew the number of grams per hour that are being consumed, we could convert that into a thrust. F equals MA.
Repeater, timeout.
F equals MA, if you know what I mean. So a couple of questions there. Liquid, the amount of thrust, and how much? In other words, is there enough fuel on board to get 2 solid years worth of thrust? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, they give it to you in newtons, but best description I've seen so far is you take a piece of paper out of your printer, put it on your hand, and that's the kind of thrust you're getting. But, you know, day in, day out, you know, from month to month, year to year, this thing is going, so it's pushing the 2,000-pound spacecraft to start, you know, with that kind of pressure. And they, like, never shut it off, you know. they might reorient the spacecraft a little to get it to go into orbit. That's about it. But to do some science. The fuel on board was a little over 1,000 pounds of liquid xenon. I forget the exact number, of course, but it was a little over 1,000 pounds, and they've used up, you know, over half of it to get into orbit of Vista, and then another couple hundred pounds to get out of orbit of Vista, and whatever they got left is going to put them into orbit around Sirius, and then they'll have about 48 pounds left to do maneuvering, you know, for science. But they don't have enough left to deorbit the, I don't know, I call it a dwarf planet. They call it an asteroid. I still think it's should be categorized as a dwarf planet similar to Pluto, but NASA's calling it an asteroid. We'll have to go with that. That's about it, Dick, for Dawn. And the pictures that you're going to get are going to be very interesting because it looks like Sirius, they think, has a lot of water. I mean, if they're talking right, it has much fresh water on that, as much water on that asteroid as we have here on Earth. Fresh water, not salt water. Back to you, Dick.
And one more comment.
Yeah, where the force is given in newtons, which is the metric system, and 1 newton is about a quarter of a pound force, 0.224 pounds force, gave me some very valuable information there that there's roughly 1,000 pounds, or a little more, of the xenon as a liquid. Any idea what temperature and what pressure is required in that tank to keep the xenon gas as a liquid? Paul, go ahead.
No, I don't remember coming across that. But any of the ion engines that they have firing here on Earth, you know, they have been going for years, you know, to test them. They don't even shut them off here. They're sitting in a room somewhere. But, you know, I'm sure that can be found real quick on a search on pressures and temperatures. Like I said, they've used them on maybe 4 or 5 different spacecraft now for practical use. Back to you.
I have some information.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, at first, there's probably a misconception when Paul says that it must work altogether. No. It's not going to work all the time. If you
you need to have an acceleration that you put there and you get the engine on. If you don't need to have an acceleration, you switch it off. Only when you add additional to the speed, there is no slow down, but you put in motion, stay in motion. So at the particular speed in space, when there is a vacuum, it's going to go, it's not going to slow down, only if you need acceleration. But you can switch a few times for the acceleration, and then you switch it off. This way you conserve the energy. But as far as the temperature, let me jump. Melting point is 161.4 Kelvin. That would be somewhere about minus 69 at the 0.15 degrees of Fahrenheit. Now, if we see the temperature of the space, it's not a problem to keep it in solid form or the liquid form. The boiling point would be 165.051 of Kelvin, which would be translated to 162.578 of Fahrenheit. What you got to do, you got to have some kind of mechanism that will actually heat it up. Yeah, well, also to create the ionic motion, you need a high voltage. But that's not a big deal. It's mostly static electricity that you at first apply for it. There is something that is being called triple point, and unfortunately, I don't know what is triple point. There is a critical point, which is the pressure. You ask for the pressure, which is somewhere about 5.842 megapascal. The heat of fusion, if you want to fuse it, would be 2.27 kilojoule per mole. And to actually,
those solar panels are about 60 feet long, so plenty of electricity for heat and for the ion thrusters.
Yeah, that's not interesting. I think you're saying that Dawn has great big solar panels that are supplying the electrical power to run the ion engine. And you said the amount of thrust of the ion engine is approximately the weight of a sheet of paper out of your printer. I don't know the weight of a sheet of paper, but I just made a wag guess that a sheet of paper is a milligram of mass. And if that's true, when you convert that into newtons, it's around 10 micro-newtons of thrust. If it was 1 milligram of thrust, 1 milligram of force. You got to be careful now with these units of weight versus force. Grams we usually use as the weight of something. Sometimes it's mass. But when it comes to pushing on something, you need grams of force, which is not necessarily grams of weight. It's a function of where you're standing. If you're on the top of Mount Everest versus the bottom of Death Valley, the same amount of mass will give you two different indications on your ordinary spring scale. You get two different weights, even though you have the exact same amount of mass. So that's part of how they separate that. So somewhere around 10 micronewtons per ion engine and 1,000 pounds of liquid. Let me drop it. Xenon, which they boil off by some means, probably just by lowering the pressure, and then accelerate it at 200,000 miles an hour at the exhaust nozzle of the ion engine. Did they say how many kilowatts or how many watts of electrical power runs that ion engine? Paul, from that we can get some very interesting numbers as to how fast they're consuming fuel in the how many pounds per 1,000 hours, if you know what I mean. WS2N, KQLIW.
Yeah, I thought it was around 400 to 700, depending on where they are. Right now they're around, 1.6 AU almost, a little bit further. And actually the opposite side of the sun, they lost contact with Dawn recently because, they call it opposition. And then when you're on the opposite side of the sun, you don't receive the signals. We don't have a repeater to locate it in 90 degrees off to the off to one side to transmit signal. So when it's on the other side of the sun, they actually lose contact. But now it just popped out on the other side, so they're back in contact and everything's running good with Dawn. So, and I'm going back to what Wesley said. He said they don't run the engines 24 hours a day. They do. Let me put it that way. But I mean, they'll shut them down if they, you know, and turn them on as they need them to you know, get to where they're going or to deorbit. But you know, most of the time they are on year after year after year. So I mean, they've been up there for quite a few years now. And the only difference is they'll fire one engine and then another engine. When this thing, you know, when I read about this 10 years ago, I heard three ion engines. That's great. The smart spacecraft and the you know had one. You know, and that was a test type of technology just to see if it would work. I thought, oh, with three, this is gonna be great. But it turns out they don't use three at once. They'll shut one down and another one will come on. I guess you know you're gonna burn it out. I guess if you went too many years in a row. And they're all working. Dick, back to you.
You did say 400 to 700. I presume that's watts of solar power. And when Dawn is doing its accelerating, do you believe almost all of that 400 to 700 watts is going into the ion engine? Is not powering any other chunk of electronics? Over to you, Paul.
Oh, you know, you've got your batteries. You've got your transmitter to get back to the deep space network, and you're going to have all your cameras. And, you know, I think it's got a half a dozen instruments on board. You know, neutron detectors and this and that. You know, to test everything. In fact, one of the tests that they have is they transmit, and as they go behind the asteroid, you could tell different densities, you know, just from transmitting and the way you receive the signal here on Earth. So all kinds of equipment on board that can be powered, you know, including the ion engine. And I'm sure now, you know, that Wesley brought up the fact that you probably have to heat the xenon gas, so I'm sure they have heaters on board to do that. I don't think they have any live plutonium on board, similar to what they have on the rovers, to create heat. But back to you, Dick.
One more comment.
That would be nice if there was a small plutonium source, so that the fluid coming out of the xenon tank could be heated to convert it to gaseous form without using electrical power. And I'm going to guess that the 400 to 700 watts of solar power is going into a whole lot of other instruments, but those other instruments only be needed to be used in brief periods of time, whereas for 24 hours a day, for some number of days, you could be operating the ionic engine. So maybe it'd be nice to know that 80% of the electrical power coming out of the solar panels is ultimately going to the ionic engine as thrust. It'd be nice if it was that way, and that some of it's not required to run a heater to heat up the xenon to make it go from liquid to a gaseous form. Over US and 2XJN, K2LAW.
Can I have a question also?
Roger.
Yes, I think we could derive from ionization energies for xenon to find out how much of power do we need for the given mass. It does have three ionization energies. So the first one would be 1170.4 kilojoules per mole to minus one. And the highest one would be 3099.4 kilojoules per mole to minus one. I was trying to see if I could be able to calculate it. I went to the Van der Waals equation, but I didn't do it yet. I've then they're smart guys that know how much energy do they need for it to have it run. Also, there is something like a heat vaporization energy. You have to heat it anyhow. You have to heat it, but that would be 12.64 kilojoules per mole to minus one. So this thing is extremely effective. What I'm trying to say is you gotta have to have a jump start. That means if you trying to create a vacuum in the diffusion pump in your bell jar, you have to first use the racking pump, and then you will be able to operate. Now, once that engine is in space, it's exactly the same concept as diffusion pump. It uses the ionis to move. If you were to start up just from the ionic engines, it would work forever, wait forever before you would be able to hit the specific speed of your choice. If you put the trust into it, and from time to time, let's say once every whatsoever month or years, you just add the trust, you're not only able to direct that object to a particle orbit or particle direction, but also you are able to increase the initial speed, and then this thing is moving at a speed with no increasing, no acceleration. Also, we would like to have a time to talk about the two thorium reactors, but it's up to you. I sent you some information.
When it comes to heat of vaporization of xenon gas, in order for me to relate it to something, I'd like to relate it to the heat of vaporization of water. So heat of vaporization of xenon gas, is it a lot higher or a lot lower than water? I'm guessing it might be lower. Water is a pretty massive material, which has got some really great thermal properties. And those thermal properties can really fight you if you're dumped into seawater at 45 degrees Fahrenheit, and if your whole body is immersed in that seawater, I think you're good for like less than an hour before your muscles no longer work because of hypothermia. So seawater can really dump heat out of you or into you real fast. So heat of vaporization of water could be quite a bit higher than xenon. John, you had a question. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick. I was just wondering, does anybody know, we know that the average temperature out there in space is roughly 3 degrees Kelvin. What is the internal temperature of the craft? Is that monitored? Do we know any information on that? Back to you, Dick.
The same.
To my knowledge, every craft we have ever launched, we do a very specific measurement of A of E, absorptivity to emissivity ratio. Literally depending on the quality of the paint you put on the outside of the spacecraft determines what temperature the spacecraft runs at, because it's continuously getting solar irradiance on the sun side, and it's continuously giving up heat on the opposite of the sun side. Most of your instruments, I'm guessing a camera, for instance, you want to run it at room temperature. I am guessing if you took an ordinary digital camera and brought it down to a cryogenic temperature, you might have some problems. Yeah, they do cryogenically cool film, and sometimes the photosensitive area of a low-light camera in order to decrease the dark noise. But I'll bet you other portions of the camera electronics, the motors that move the focus and the zoom lens and so on, the substantial portions of the spacecraft, I am guessing, have to be near room temperature to run correctly. So you use the right kind of paint, so to speak, on the outside of the spacecraft, and the sun will do an awful lot of that for you. In fact, some of those spacecraft will have louvers where you can change the orientation of the louvers in, as a method of actively adjusting the temperature like a servo mechanism. Let's see what Paul's going to say about this. WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, I just want to mention that the engines themselves, they can move them, physically move the engines to adjust the attitude control. So that takes care of that. And I was trying to look up how many pounds I did find there. I was a little off. It's 937 pounds of the Xeon propellant. I have that in my old notes, Dick. You know, by the way, you talked earlier about the possibility of going into orbit with chemical engines. It wouldn't be possible with the rockets that we have. The rocket would have to be enormous to get that kind of capability to orbit and deorbit and then reorbit another body the way they're doing it. So I just wanted to bring that up too, Dick. This is all launched on a Delta II. You know, this thing wasn't launched on a Saturn V rocket. Back to you.
Do you have a personal view, Paul, about whether or not that space elevator will ever be established in the lifetime of my offspring? I'm a bit skeptical. It's a good idea on paper, but the strength of the materials required and the risks involved, I mean, aircraft running into it, a hurricane running into it, a boat running into the anchor point, comets, what's the word I'm looking for now? Yeah, literally, comets, not the right word. Things that dive into the Earth, you know what I mean. Why can't I think of the name of the
meteors?
That's the word, meteors. Meteors and meteorites. If they hit the fabric of your space elevator and cut it, that's going to create some strong, salty language, because any megabucks of establishing the space elevator goes down the tube. If you cut that tether, it'll go flying off into space, and that's the end. You'll never see any of that material again, because the top of the space elevator is moving considerably faster than the velocity required for geosynchronous orbit. So I think we're going to study it for a long time to come. Until we have the ability to build graphite-reinforced materials of real long lengths. I mean, right now you can build a few millimeters, maybe a centimeter of this stuff. Until you can build this stuff in multiple meters of length and then weave it together. Right now, I think that's the strongest strength to weight ratio material we know of, graphite reinforced materials. What do they call it now? The hexagonal structure, there's a name for it. So what do you think about the space elevator, Paul? That would be a nice, cheap way of getting stuff into space. As it is right now, each pound you launch into space, I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me it's $100,000 per pound, I'd believe it. WS2N, K2LIW.
What about some of the hurricane winds, Dick? What do you think about that?
That's also something else to worry about. Let's see what Paul thinks about all of this.
Orbit was $1,000 a pound, and the moon is $10,000 a pound. I forgot what Mars is, but it's up there. When you think about, 180-pound guy going into a rocket, what it costs to get him into the space station. All the food, all the water. Progress spacecraft goes up there, and sometimes it's half-filled with water, half-filled with fuel. The Progress spacecraft is nothing but the same thing as a Soyuz spacecraft without living quarters, the rest of it. All this cargo. And to support these guys, we have the H-2 going up by Japan to support the space station. You've got got the Dragon going up, the Cygnus. Well, that's not going up for a while, but that'll be going up on, a, on an Atlas at the end of the year. They made a deal with Boeing to launch the Cygnus. But each time they go up, they put, you know, 4,000 pounds of stuff on the space station just to supply six people. So, to make it cheaper, yeah, the space elevator would might work. The carbon-carbon material, whatever it is that they, they're making the, they want to make the cable out of. About a year ago, I remember reading that they got a long way to go to perfect that. So I think we're going to be seeing people walk on, probably on a moon, Titan. Never mind Mars, but Titan, before you ever see any space elevators being constructed. My guess, that's 100 years down the road. But to make it cheaper, I guess SpaceX has the right idea. You know, they're going to bring it down 100 fold, so take two zeros off that 1,000 to put something in all of it. That's what they want to do by having reusability. There's a couple of people that want to do that. Of course, I mentioned one earlier that European Space Agency is working on it. They got the Skyline that they're developing, which would take off like a plane and land like a plane. Be able to go to a space station. You've got the Dragon, which will bring up people to the space station. The cargo Dragon, which will still be functioning. You need reusability, and SpaceX is leading the way with that. If they can bring the first stage back, and eventually someday the second stage back, there's plans on doing that. The only thing they're going to be throwing away in the long run would be the service modules of the crewed Dragon. The rest of it, everything will come back. The spacecraft will come back with propulsion, maybe parachutes for the crews in the early NASA space station days when that's first used. They'll be able to bring it down to, you know, $10 a pound to put something in orbit, because they'll be reusing the first stages. I mean, we tried that. NASA tried that to some extent. They had reusable boosters for the space shuttle. They had reusable RS-25 engines, three of them on board the space station, on board the space shuttle. The all the OMES, the orbital. Call them the OMES retro rockets that they use. Those were all reusable. But you've got to do it where you don't have to practically rebuild everything after you bring it back. And SpaceX looks like they're leading the way on that. A lot of other companies that are involved. Boeing will have some kind of reusability with their spacecraft, but they still want to launch on expendable rockets. No good. You got to bring the price down, Dick. Back to you, WS2N.
When you said $1,000 per pound to get it into orbit, I remember hearing that number during the Apollo program, 1970 time frame. I think that number is a lot higher now, Paul. I think it's a lot higher than $1,000 a pound to get it into orbit. You said that the cargo ships going to the International Space Station deliver 4,000 pounds of material to maintain six people on the space station. That's 4,000 pounds of material. I am guessing a high percentage of that is the consumables that the humans use. Food, oxygen, water, and some of it is replacement hardware. That's 4,000 pounds. How many times per year is that required? Because once you answer that, I'm going to show you where I'm going with this. 4,000 pounds per cargo mission. Are there four of those or six of those per year? WS2N, K2LAW.
Extrapolate that to Mars, Dick, and you got your problem, right?
Well, that's a little bit of it, but you'll see where I'm going with this. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, you like the numbers, Dick. I know the International Space Station is 1 million pounds. Yeah, you got 1 million pounds. And this thing is taking, what, so the first thing that was launched was 1999. Unity and the Zesda out of the, functioning cargo block by Russia. First two pieces. Dozens and dozens of pieces after that. All these years later, what are we, 15, 16 years later, 1 million pounds. It's a $100 billion project, collectively, not only the United States, but Russia put money into it, European Space Agency, Japan, everybody. So you can do a quick calculation there, and that will give you an idea of how much per pound to put something into orbit. I think that would be the best way to go, because that would be a good average over time. Yeah, I remember those numbers back in the early days too, but things have gotten better at, more rockets going up. The price has come down per pound, not gone up. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, 100 billion is 10 to the 11 dollars, and 1 million pounds is 10 to the 6 pounds. Wow. 10 to the 6 pounds, 10 to the 11 dollars, is 10 to the 5 dollars per pound. $100,000 per pound. Now, you're not just launching material to build the International Space Station. That $100 billion is a lot of manufacturing cost for the materials, maintaining of people. There's a lot going into it, but if I just do a simple calculation, $100 billion and 1 million pounds, that's $100,000 a pound is what it has cost us. Now, the $4,000 of cargo that's delivered on each cargo trip. Make a rough guess, Paul, how many cargo trips to the International Space Station, bringing them consumables? How many of those per year? Rough guess on your part, now, Paul, go ahead.
Question. Okay, let me see. Probably 8 flights for the progress. Probably for the, there was planned 4 for the Dragon. So you're looking at 12, and then probably 3 for the Cygnus, 13, 14, 15. H2 was supposed to be 2, 16, 17, and 1 per year for the ATV, which was equivalent to like 3 of them, you know. ATV was big. So you're roughly 20 loads per year. Per year, I'm going to go with it. What was planned? I think it's coming out less than that, though, with all these delays and problems. But, so there you go, Dick. 4,000 pound loads of stuff. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. 4,000 pounds, 20 of them. That sounds like 80,000 pounds of consumables per year to maintain 6 people. Now, some of that is hardware, you know, a motor replacement, a rotary joint replacement, a computer replacement, and so on. But I suspect that a high percentage of that is human consumption material, and let me show you why. I was doing a little bit of inverse investigation of this in the last few days. I remember from years ago saying that when you're doing planning for an air conditioning system for a movie theater or any other kind of theater, a human being sitting in the seat is dissipating heat at 450 BTUs per hour. The human being is sitting there giving off heat 400 BTUs per hour. That's just sitting and listening. He's not jumping up and down because you're playing wild music. Let me drop it.
It's fuel, too. I forgot about the fuel. That's part of it, part of that number.
And maybe by fuel you mean thrusting fuel, because you have to do a certain amount of thrusting to keep it in orbit. Is that what you mean by fuel, Paul, or is this fuel to run the thrusters on board? About 4,000 pounds, some of that is the fuel that does boosting. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
A lot of weight. A lot of hydrazine fuel is the main fuel that they bring up for Cobra is usually loaded into the Zesda, that's the main module, the Russians, they usually blast that, those thrusters to do it, it's at the back end of the space station, so that's what really accelerates it.
Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a feel for what's required to maintain a human being. A human being sitting in a seat in a theater, 450 BTUs per hour of heat is given off by that human being because of his internal metabolism. If you convert that into units that's a little more familiar to us, that's 132 watts. So in other words, sitting in that theater seat, you're giving off the same amount of heat as a 132-watt incandescent light bulb. Assuming you're gathering the light. When you're sleeping and you go down to the basal metabolism rate, that 132 watts goes down to something like 98 watts. Throughout the day, though, you average a good 125 watts of continuous power output, thermal power output. That's because you're metabolizing food, you're consuming food, water, and oxygen. And the people who do survival talk about the units of threes. You can't do without oxygen for more than 3 minutes. You can't do without water for more than 3 days. You can't do without food for more than 3 weeks. You violate any one of those threes, and the chances of the person surviving are not good. Let me drop. So here you are. By the way, 132 watts, you can convert that into kilocalories, and it's around 2,200 kilocalories per day of consumable metabolizable food. Just the raw food going into you, not counting the water. And then some number of pounds of water and some significant number of pounds of oxygen must continuously flow into you to keep you alive. And there's no way of stopping that. You're not going to say, hey, I'm going to put this guy into hibernation instead of 125 watts per 24 hours continuously being supplied by the energy I'm pouring into his mouth and his nose, so to speak. Instead of doing that, I'm going to put him into hibernation. It's going to require a lot less. You can see why I say that to send a man to Mars, where each year he's going to consume an amount of volume of materials equal to the volume of your house, no matter how tightly you pack it, and the mass of that material is roughly the mass of your house. You are a 130-watt engine that cannot be turned off 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. 130 watts of energy must be poured into you, otherwise we don't call you alive. And now that you've told me 4,000 pounds of material are brought up to the International Space Station, roughly 20 times per year, gives you a little bit of a feeling of what's required to maintain life. What have you ever heard of these terms before, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
The one book, Packing for Mars, but something close to that, but not quite. I tried to break it down a little bit. So, Dick, maybe it's going to be a while before we get to Mars, but there's plans on, launching all this equipment out there, launching food there, landing our vehicles on Mars with fuel on board, manufacturing fuel off the planet before you even send people there. There's all these long-range plans. I read about them all the time. And, just going there. They're not going to go in the little Orion spacecraft. They're going to make a couple of habitat modules. They call them the Habitat 500. And that's what they're going to live in. With that, they're going to need food. When they get there, they're going to need oxygen. All kinds of stuff they're going to have to dock with in orbit. They might even have to have a space station around Mars before they even think about going down to land. So we're a long way off. Back to you, Dick. This is WS20.
About 3 minutes, Dick.
Yeah, the first question that the multiple nations of planet Earth are going to have to agree to fund this project. The first question the majority of those nations are going to ask is, what do I get in return? Why do I want to do this? Why do I want to send a human being to a planet that has essentially no atmosphere? You continuously bathe with the solar wind, with cosmic rays, with all kinds of dangerous stuff that's going to be hitting you continuously. You're at a temperature of minus 100 degrees centigrade. To maintain a human being in a minus 100 degrees centigrade temperature environment with no air and one-third gravity, wow, it is the driest desert on the surface. Yeah, there's some water below the surface. And whenever you do any maneuvering, you're going to have to be in a spacesuit. You talk to an astronaut who has spent 8 hours in a spacesuit where the bottom of his body is held together with a diaper. I don't think I have to go any deeper into that one. You don't want to live that way. You don't want to go there. I mean, curiosity can make all kinds of measurements. The last thing in the world you want to do is send a human being to that extremely cold, extremely hostile, extremely dangerous, extremely expensive environment. You don't want to send a human being there. Let me drop.
Classic answer, Dick, because it's there.
In the case of a mountain where it's there, yes. You take a week or two going there and a week or two coming back. When it comes to $1 trillion of cost, maybe $2 trillion of cost, 3 years of life in the most dangerous environment with no rescue capability and a very unpleasant lifestyle, I don't see it happening. Okay, this was TechNet number 1532. We're going to settle some of these issues next week. We're going to get back to Vito's beautiful question on a potentiometer, and there's multiple ways of using and evaluating the use of a potentiometer and choosing the right value of the potentiometer. We're going to get back to that. Over to you, Paul, for any comments. I'm sorry I didn't get back to you, Wes. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Great net, and I thank everybody for participating. We had quite a few on Echolink and the chat room. Look to see you all back again next week. If everything goes well, we'll be here too. KC2WG. Back to you, Dick.
I was talking into the wrong microphone. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Don't take it seriously. You're not going to get out of this one alive. You better enjoy the process. K2LIW clear.
73, guys. Have a good one. We'll talk to you next week. If not, the WS-20.
W2HL. Is there a power fail? W2HL. Is there any guys lose power? We lost power over here in Brooklyn.
Audio level test ready.
Activity timeout.
Welcome to W2VL repeat. Glen Oaks, New York, node number 448.
Link active.
Thank you for visiting W2VL repeat, node number 4438.
Link clear.
This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta test. V7LTD, testing 123. This is Victor Echo 7, Lima Tango Delta with an audio test. Audio test 123, VE7LTD.
Met tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
KC2WGB testing. KC2WGB clear.
Clear, see ya.
Yeah, well, sounds good.
You guys still at it? I heard the tech set the tech note over an hour ago.
Yeah, okay. Maybe Roy is there. We had a good discussion, but Roy wasn't with us. And so, John and Todd is back on 850. I'm going to take a break a little bit. Todd, are you there?
Good evening, John and Wes. No, to Wesley, I say chess.
Okay. John, are you there?
KC2WGB. Oh, yeah, still hanging out. Still lurking about in the lurch.
82CBV with a question. Why did they discontinue your simply fluoroscope, I believe it was, because didn't that predate the modern X-ray?
Well, it was another tool for the physicians. It still exists. It's used in some cases, but that was an extremely dangerous instrument. A lot of people suffered injuries from that.
Right. It was more dangerous with whatever it emitted, but did it not also permit you to look at, say, a live shot versus the X-ray, which is a photograph?
Yes, it did, and it killed a lot of doctors because of the constant exposure.
Yeah, okay. But what kind of radiation does that use? I mean, is that also X-rays or not?
I believe it was, yes. I'm pretty sure. It's been a long time since I've read about it, but I believe it was, yes.
Okay, you cleared that up for me. I was wondering, based on the previous conversation.
Basically, it was a fluorescent screen that went to fluorescence from the radiation emitted from the X-ray machine, which was, say, in back of the patient, going through the patient and lighting up the screen, exciting those photons. Those photons would excite the phosphor.
So the emitter was, say, behind the patient, went through the patient, hit the screen, and then the doctor's looking at the screen and being bombarded. Is that essentially it?
Yes, basically that's it. We also had those ones you used to stick your feet in to see if the shoe fit correctly. That was basically a fluoroscope, too.
Okay, I was just, trying to get it straight in my head, in my people mind, I guess. The thing I've always wondered about, as you go from doctor to doctor, or, say, dentist, and then a GP who sent you for X-rays, where the heck is the count? Because X-rays are cumulative. And I wonder where the count is, because nobody correlates this stuff. You know what I'm driving at, right?
Well, that's changed over the years. You know, at one time, you had to be careful how many X-rays you had, and you were only allowed a certain amount per year. But the truth of the matter is, they don't know what the real number is that's acceptable. They just came up with a number, these idiots. And, you know, that's what they went by. It seemed to work, but now with the new CMOS devices and much better film, X-rays are far lower than they were in those days. And dental X-rays are extremely low, and they do a pretty good job.
So, if you say X amount a year, granted, we don't know what the RAD level is, if there is a safe level, but if you say X number a year, does that mean that if, let's say you're exposed to 10 RADs in 2000, and it wears because I, my understanding, that doesn't mean much in this case, Trump. My understanding is that if you get 10 rads in 2000 and you get 10 rads in 2010, you've got 20 rads, regardless of the time frame. So you're telling me that there's a possibility the time frame can affect it, so you would have less than 20 rads in 2010?
Well, I have a very limited knowledge in it, but from what I understand, x-rays can damage tissue. And they claim that if it's under the specific allowed amount, most of that damage should disappear and dissipate. The body renews the cells, and it goes on. The next year you get another acceptable amount of rads, you will still maintain. Your body will replace things that are damaged. But when you get an excessive amount of x-rays, it'll do more damage and in different ways, and there lies the problem from what I understand. Not that the x-rays disappear, it's the damage is repaired.
Okay, I got it. So, in other words, it's quantity over time and the amount of damage that may go beyond repair. And theoretically, if you're talking about somebody who's 90, the body may not be able to repair what it did, say, when said person was 40. Is that as well correct?
Yes, basically correct, because as you get older, your body slows down, its ability to replicate slows down, metabolism, you know, all of that, things don't work as well. So, of course, your recovery is going to take a longer time. But somebody who's in their 90s really doesn't have to worry about if they're collectively getting x-rays, because they're not going to live much longer than that anyway.
I don't know. I thought that was when you were 105 or more. I'm so confused. Where is Dr. Roy when we meet him?
Well, look, we're idiots. He's intelligent. He's probably sleepy because he has to work tomorrow.
Nah. I did my work for the weekend. And I sent it on its way, and I don't want to hear it from them, and I'm very angry about it. So, it's done. They want to get their knickers in a wad over something. They don't want to train people, and they want to pass the buck on to me. Come on, please.
Well, you know, you just stick with the program. Whatever you're responsible for, you make sure you do it, and do it right. And then the hell with everybody else. Let them all fight. Tell them to go someplace else and fight amongst themselves. Don't concern me and don't involve me. I did my job.
John, KD2CBV, if you only knew half the stuff I did. I am retired. Leave me alone. You know, we can conscript you. I'm perfectly aware of that. In the meantime, leave me alone.
Conscription does not equal cooperation. Sure, let them do it.
Yeah. You know what, sometimes I feel like time. Look, I'm bleeping blind. I can't do it anymore. Leave me alone.
Yeah, I mean, if they don't listen to reason, you're talking to the wrong people. That's all.
Guys, I'm doing my stuff, but John, when you look at your email, there is also email in regards to today's conversation about AC resistance measurement. I sent a beautiful article to Dick, you, and Roy, which shows how that to be measured. It's not that simple, as he says, when I was postulating that we're dealing with impedance. I was right, but there is a technique that is able to apply AC into the resistance measurement of the liquid. Of course, pH is important, but it shows extremely nice on the peak picture, so it's a slight presentation of how that works. So you might be interested with that as well.
Well, in the subject we were speaking of, impedance has nothing to do with it. pH has nothing to do with it. none of that counts. Exactly what Dick said is what happens. Now, yes, if you're looking for different values and you're looking at, you know, different frequency, stuff like that, yeah, you're right. But at 60 hertz and specifically what we were talking about, none of that applies.
No, the article that I have sent you is in general about measuring resistivity and conductivity.